This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Once again, we welcome you listeners to come back this week and hear this week's episode. We know there's so much content out there and other podcasts that you can listen to and other types of streaming videos and whatnot that can keep you occupied, but we appreciate you coming back week after week and listening to the great content that we offer here in our conversations with conjurers. This week's episode is brought to you again by the Friends of the Magic Word. Those are the ones who support the Magic Word with their financial pledges and their donations. If you would like to join the Friends of the Magic Word and get some pretty cool perks along the way, then go over to themagicwordpodcast.com, and there you'll see a button. You can click on that to become a friend, and you can watch a video, learn all that you need to know in order to help us. So please do that if you have the financial ability, because right now, during these times, it's just even more important than usual that we will appreciate your support. Well, this week we are welcoming a guest and someone that perhaps you may have seen at some magic conventions, and he is someone that runs a auction house that auctions off a lot of stuff, but they specialize in magic memorabilia and as well as other types of ephemera and all kinds of really cool stuff. This is Gabe Fiore, who's going to be joining me, and Gabe is one of the owners, along with his father, whenever they founded Potter and Potter Auctions House, and that in this podcast he'll talk a little bit about how that came about and also just some interesting stories about things that have come through the auction house, how they got into business then to begin with, of course, and a lot of really interesting things. But the meat of this really, I think, is closer towards the end that will affect really all of us. So I don't want to get too maudlin or melancholy, nor macabre even, or any other M word for that matter. But I think it's important that we do kind of take some time to assess our mortality, knowing there's another M word, knowing that eventually that we're going to pass and we're going to have to pass on all of our magic stuff to someone to take care of, to be a curator or to sell to somebody or whatever. But we need to be conscientious of that. And that's one of the things that Gabe talks about a little bit here towards the end of this podcast. Just some things that just a good kind of a wake-up call and an assessment of something I think that is worthwhile that we should all pay attention to. I also want to thank Gabe for the prizes that he is offering. That is two sets of two books, each of the Golden Age of Magic posters that was from the Nielsen Magic auction that happened a few years ago, and they are beautiful books. Again, these are books that were sent out for the auction and letting you know what was going to be up for sale. And of course, the sale has come and gone, but the pictures, full color, and the quality of the book is just amazing. And so we'll give you more information about that on the backside of this podcast. So stick around after the podcast is over to learn how that you can enter the contest for a chance to win one of two sets of these books. So let me introduce my guest here this week, because he's got a lot to say and some important stuff, too, I think, for all of us. Please welcome my guest this week, Mr. Gabe Fiore, here on The Magic Word. Well, today I have with me a guest from Chicago, Illinois, who many of you have seen or heard or maybe even participating in some of his auctions. He is the proprietor of Potter & Potter Auctions and also a publisher for Squash Printing. And we're going to be getting into all that, plus just, I think, a lot of really interesting topics. So let me jump right in and introduce my friend and guest here today, Mr. Gabe Fiore. Hi there, Gabe.
Hey, Scott, how are you?
Fantastic, sir. Thank you very much for joining me. I've been looking forward to this for a long time. You know, we get a visit with each other from time to time at Magic Live and a few other conventions and everything, and that's got to be really kind of difficult to decide what kind of items you bring to conventions. In other words, I know, like, when I talk with Dick Hatch and Charlie Randall, when they're going to take books, it's like, well, they usually take some of the newest books and perhaps a few things that might be some bestsellers. But when you're taking things, how do you decide what you think it is that people might be interested in wanting to buy?
Yeah, I think it's on a convention by convention basis. So based on the size of the convention, maybe the types of acts that are going to be there. Although, in all honesty, sometimes it doesn't matter, because typically when we set up a booth at a convention, we're the only outfit that is of that ilk at that convention. We're really usually the only people with antiquarian books or vintage posters or autographs or things like that.
Right.
At a Magic Live, of course, I'm going to take five times as much as I would to another convention.
Sure.
But we don't. Also, we don't exhibit at too many of them. But let's say Dave Williamson is going to be on the bill. I might try to find a nice first edition of his book or things of that nature. It kind of varies depending on who's performing or what the subject matter may be of the particular event we're going to be displaying at.
Right. And sometimes, of course, don't want to jump ahead, but I know there's a squash printing that you might have a book perhaps that might be new that you're wanting to roll out, or perhaps the person who is the author or the subject of the book will be there so that way that he or she can sign the books.
100%. I've had some incredibly successful launches of books at Magic Live. I think I'm probably not alone in that, but John Bannon books, John Lovick's book, Handsome Jack. Things like that have done very well when launched at a major convention.
Yeah, I know that Stan typically likes to have something at his convention that's going to be new and a new rollout kind of a thing. So he asks all of his dealers to, you know, hold back whatever they're going to be releasing. Let's release it there. And so that is a perfect time. So we have something really good. So that's great. Well, let me go back again. I wanted to first of all talk about Potter & Potter Auctions. Now, you told me many years ago, I guess it was really you and your father that had started that. Is that right? Can you tell me something about kind of the beginnings of that?
That's correct. That's correct. With Jay Marshall's passing, I had an opportunity to get into the auction business without going into a long, long discussion. I've been training for this job since before I knew I was ever going to have it. Uh-huh. I was selling things on eBay to help pay my way through college, on consignment for people, auctioning things off like that. My father had an auction business in Detroit when I was growing up as a sideline to his law practice. So I've been around antiques and collectibles and selling magic for other people for a long, long time. And then after Jay passed away and I got involved in the appraisal of his estate, then there was an opportunity to start an auction company and start auctioning off magic as a profession.
When your father had the auction house, was he kind of going out and doing estate auctions where I've seen, like, I'm from Southern Illinois, and I remember seeing a lot of auctions at farms and homes out in the country where they go out and they'll sell machinery and, of course, all the goods from the house and all that kind of thing. So was he one of those fast-talking auctioneer kind of a guys?
Absolutely not. He had a very specialized auction in kind of in the way we do now. He and his partner sold. They were both attorneys. Yep. They had a sideline selling stamps, collectible postage stamps. Huh. And so they sold collections of stamps. They sold primarily to dealers. It was primarily, you got to remember, this is 30 years ago. So they put together a little catalog. They'd fax out to guys I can't remember if it was every 4 weeks or every 2 weeks, but they ran this business as a sideline for 15, 20 years or something, and kept them in the hobby. It was never, the lion's share of anybody's income, but they would rent a room at a local, I believe it was a hotel, and they'd set it up and put everything on display. And then on a Monday night for 4 or 5 hours, they'd sell these stamp collections. They could be things going back 100 years. They could be modern collections, so on and so forth. You know, it's not anything like what we do, and it's very much like what we do.
That is fascinating. I really hadn't thought too much about what the old-time auctions must have certainly been like before what we're used to now. I mean, you get so used to where we are that you kind of forget about what it would have been like back then, just like with, I guess, mail-order magic and catalogs and everything like that. But, of course, the numismatists, I can't pronounce that correctly, how do you pronounce stamp collecting? Anyhow.
You're talking about philatelists.
Philatelists, yes.
Philatelic pursuits, things related to stamps. So it's philately. You're thinking of
coins.
I believe numismatists, which are coin collectors, concerned with coins. Yeah.
So the stamp collectors, I'll just leave it at that. Years ago, when he was doing that and putting together catalogs, I know that they've been having conventions just like magicians have had for years then also. And so he would probably go, and did he auction or just have a booth, or what was that like way back in the day?
They just ran the auctions. I'm not saying he didn't go to stamp shows or you know, go to other auctions of stamp collections. There was a very active one in Detroit that he attended all the time. But all auctions have kind of become more of a retail pursuit with the advent of the internet. You know, it used to be, did you get the catalog? Maybe you didn't get the catalog. Did you hear about, you know, now, at least with our Magic auctions, if you are the average collector or maybe performer, you have the ability to go online, bid online, live, you know, watch me tell bad jokes while, you know, we we auction this stuff off now that we're streaming the auctions live.
Yeah.
I remember going to an auction in New York City in 1997 at Swan Galleries. This was an event, you know. I mean, there's
a coat and tie and everything for that kind of a thing, right?
I think I was 18, so I definitely wasn't wearing a coat or tie. But certainly people were not wearing sandals and, you know, Hawaiian shirts. But there was a great sense of camaraderie. You know, my recollection is there's 50 or 75 of us packed into this room in Gramercy Park. And, it was really a happening. Now, you know, like I said, you can watch the live stream and watch the auction as it goes on. So you can kind of feel like you're there. But in all honesty, the number of people who show up live, usually there's not much of a crowd at a live auction. You can participate online from the comfort of your own home.
Yeah. Well, also that the name of Potter and Potter, that was from a relative, distant relative of yours?
You're close. The distant relative is me and my father. So it's a translation of our last name.
Fiori means Potter.
Fahuri, which is actually an Arabic name spelled in a Chilean way. I don't know how confused you want to be today or how much work you want to do into etymology, but the Arabic spelling of our name is F-A-K-H-O-U-R-I. We have hundreds of relatives who spell their name that way. And Fakhuri, or Fahuri, as my family pronounces it, translates to Potter.
So with your father and you with the same last name, hence the name.
There
Fahuri,
you go.
Fahuri. Yeah.
Fahuri. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Got it. Okay. But he's really no part of this. At this point, it's pretty much you?
Well, look, it's a team effort. There's 10 or 12 people working here every day. My dad is one of them. I'm the president. I'm the guy, you know, where the blame, you know, falls or the praise falls, depending on
the buck stops there.
We've done that day. The buck stops here. But yeah, the two of us started it off, and at this point, I'm, for better or worse, I'm the guy in charge.
Okay. One more thing I do want to go back to. I kind of cut you a little bit short when you were starting to talk about the Jay Marshall collection and acquiring that. And I remember years ago going with Jay, and he was giving me a guided tour back in the catacombs, quite literally under the alley and back room and downstairs and upstairs and all that kind of stuff, and showed me where Frances was laying and sleeping at night there back in towards the end of her life and everything. But seeing all that stuff and those posters all rolled up and stuck back in those little dust bins and everything over there, yeah. That must have been a gargantuan task of
I mean, that doesn't even begin to describe it. It's Jay had, best guess, 250,000 books at Magic Incorporated and the two buildings behind it. He had, we estimate, if you count all the floors and all the property, probably 30,000-40,000 square feet packed with stuff, stuffed into rafters and under floorboards and in cupboards.
Under floorboards?
I mean, it was
wow.
It was like an episode of Hoarders, Scott. I mean, yes. There's stuff under beds, on beds. It's the kind of thing where you couldn't even see the furniture. There was so much stuff stacked up in many rooms.
That's true. He told me that he didn't want much. He just wanted it all.
Yeah, well, he almost succeeded. He almost succeeded, and it was trash and it was treasure all mixed together. And so I took a leave of absence from my job at the time for 6 months to work on the project with David Meyer, my good friend. And we didn't even handle the things that weren't magic related. We just handled the magic related items. There's another appraiser who did the rest of it. It was, I mean, renting trucks and...
Because he had marionettes and everything, too, puppets and whatnot.
He had puppets. He had books on sex. He had things on tattoos. He had broken bicycles. He had, Cat Fancy magazines. He had Houdini memorabilia and audio tapes and bookbinding equipment. And I mean, you know, polymath, I think, is the way some people refer to somebody who can do just about anything. And Jay certainly tried just about everything and tried to collect many things on hundreds of subjects. I mean, it got to the point where the Salvation Army nearby said, stop donating books. You cannot bring us anymore. We do not have any more room. It was off the charts.
Wow. And so as you were cataloging all of the magic stuff, and you said, was there another group or groups who were saying, okay, well, that would be in my category of bicycles or whatever else? Or I mean, somebody else was doing it the same simultaneous?
Those people were just the garbage men in the area. But okay. Yes, there are other things that were collectible, show business material. There's, of course, family memorabilia, things that his sons and family wanted to keep. But, I mean, a lot of things had to get literally had to get thrown away. You know, when you look under a bed and all the roaches, you know, scatter, you know, some of that stuff is not salvageable. But then you look under another bed and you find a first edition of The Discovery of Witchcraft, you know. Mm-hmm. So it some days were just horrifying, and other days were like raiding King Tut's tomb. It was highs and lows altogether.
I thought that he had some sort of an agreement also with David Copperfield for some items. So did David come in first and take the things, or was that a private thing you can't discuss? No.
He had sold his poster collection to Norm Nielsen and David Copperfield in the 1990s. They had split that up. He had an agreement with Bob Lund, and Bob Lund was the founder of the American Museum of Magic in Marshall. And the agreement was whoever dies first gets the other collector's library. Well, Bob Lund died first in 1995, and Jay said, I don't want this. This is insane. So Jay basically, and I don't remember the exact wording, but he basically said, whatever the museum doesn't already have, I will donate. Hmm. And that means, look, they don't need their 10th set of Tarbell Course in Magic.
Right.
But if there's something special, you know, for example, they had the first edition of Erdenes, but it was the copy owned by the binder, the man who actually bound all the books. Hmm. Or there was a copy of Revelations by Vernon, the first version that Mike Caveney put out in 1984. It was annotated by Ed Marlowe in the margins with all of his comments on, you know, this slide should be adjusted this way, or so on and so forth. Then it was re-annotated. Marlowe's annotations were re-annotated by Vernon. Somebody took them out to Vernon and said, what do you think of Ed's comments? And Vernon, you know, so things like that. But the other items, the things that the museum already had examples of, well, those didn't get donated. And that's what put us into the auction business. I mean, I'm glossing over some of the details, but mm-hmm. after we filled a 26-foot truck and sent it to Marshall, Michigan, there were piles and piles and piles and piles of great stuff, and we had an auction. And then, long story longer, the museum said, you know what, we don't really need any stuff. Thank you for this donation. We'd rather have money. We're going to give you the stuff back. Just give us some money so we can keep going. And now we really had an auction business, because now all this other great material came back from Marshall. And that really put us in the game.
Is that when you decided to do Potter Potter full time and to quit your other job?
Yeah, that second
wave
of Jay's stuff. Yeah, in 2008, and eventually I was doing enough auction work that I got fired from my old job, and I thank my old boss every day for firing me. I only wish he would have done it sooner. And so here we are.
Yeah, so you're down there. I was going to say 24/7. I mean, you were saying earlier that you, before we began, that you're only about a mile from your house, so you can go down there quite easily.
Yep, absolutely.
And so there are things that are coming in from time to time, and that's what I think is kind of interesting then, too, is how did you come across those things. Now, as far as Jay's stuff, and that you're in Chicago and you're friends with Jay, how did you get to be the guy as far as getting that to begin with?
Through David Meyer,
okay.
Who was named in Jay's trust as the person to figure out what to do with all of the magic.
Right. And as you were saying earlier, Dave is the one who's your partner helping you a lot now.
David's not involved in our business, but he was involved in the appraisal back in 2005 when we started that job. And then once we completed that and had that first auction, David said, I'm out. This is it. I've had enough. I've done my duty to my friend. It's all yours.
Yeah, yeah. So in getting additional things, do people come to you? Do you solicit them? I mean, obviously, after you had the J. Marshall auction, that you suddenly overnight became the company to handle that, although there are others, like you said, Swan, and I know still that there are other auctions that are going on in some other auction houses even, but people come to you then? I mean, like I know recently Jim Rollins and others have had their collection that have been coming to you.
Sure. It's, you know, hopefully if we're doing a good job, the phone's going to ring, and fortunately, it's been ringing a lot. Mm-hmm. I would say I almost have a phobia in terms of being aggressive and seeking out collections. There was a stigma for years that the magic dealer was, you know, standing in line at the funeral, yeah, you know, waiting to talk to the widow about the estate. There's a funny story about Flosso and Dunninger and all that. You know, and somebody approached Mrs. Dunninger at the wake, and before the guy could get the sentence out of his mouth, Mrs. Dunninger looked at this guy who had no tact, and she said, "Flosso got to me first." You know, I mean, it was like, anyway. So I had this phobia about ever being perceived at this as this vulture.
That's what my wife always had said, that if I go first, that she said, you know, Dick Hatch and Charlie Randall are very close friends, but she said, I know they'll be the first ones to call me. And I hope they do, because you got too much crap you got to get rid of.
Well, look, we are providing a real service, because in many instances you end up in a situation where somebody doesn't know what to do. I was just in a circumstance in California where the gentleman called me literally weeks before he died. And he said, look, you've got to help my wife. And I'm only too happy to, but he called me, you know,
yeah.
I almost go out of my way not to be contacting, estates and situations like that. And remember, Scott, we're also in so many different categories now. At the end of August, we're selling slot machines and arcade games and advertising and Coca-Cola material. You know, it's really all you have in this business is your reputation. You don't really have a lot of inventory. So if we do a good job, we get a referral or our name is out there. Somebody sees a catalog or work we've done or a result we've achieved and the phone will ring. I'm not saying I won't call anyone.
Yeah.
But it has to be under the right circumstances.
Why did you decide to branch out, or was it just kind of a natural evolution? There happened to be some of these other items as part of the collection that you acquired and were going to be selling, or did someone, let's say like a Coca-Cola or the slot machines and things like that, was that something that's like, well, is your mission statement such that it will allow for additional things rather than being myopic just on magic only?
Well, I mean, I think it's the same as the guy. You know, it's just smart business, right? It's the
sure.
same as the guy who, you know, he makes ceiling fans and he's got one customer named Walmart. And one day Walmart says, hey, you know what? We found somebody who can supply these for less. All of a sudden you're out of business.
Right.
You know, I'm not saying that, you know, someday we're not going to have any customers for magic material. But, hey, markets change, trends change. Interest, you know, waxes and wanes.
Look at baseball cards, for an example. Wow, up and down.
I mean, I wish I was in that business, I'll tell you, because,
really?
You know, when we sell, well, we do sell baseball cards, you know, and last year I think we had a Mickey Mantle rookie in horrible condition. Oh, man, I was falling all over myself to sell it. I mean, it was so easy to, not a great card, $7,000 or something, you know.
Hmm.
I mean, a great one is, you know, they're north of a million if it's the right card, you know.
Wow.
Modern cards, yeah, not so interested.
But I know they've had their conventions also where they've been selling cards, and it used to be that they were a lot, and then they started going down. And I don't know whether that was a product or a function of just the economy or perhaps interest or people who were buying it were dying off or what.
I guess I would say at a high level it's never been more active and vibrant, you know. But
really?
I think what you're talking about is – like the bastardization of the hobby. In other words, you know, we're going to make this one that has foil and this one that has, you know,
holograms,
this one,
yeah.
Da, 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 da. And they've taken something that was kind of pure and interesting and they've turned it into the Franklin Mint. You know, it's kind of like manufactured collectability. But in terms of like comic books and baseball cards and other collectibles of that nature, even, you know, 1960s era rock concert posters, Disney memorabilia. We had a huge Disney auction earlier this year. Those markets are very, very active. Very active, yes.
And they're much larger, obviously, than our small Magic community.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, a lot of people went to the ballpark as a kid, and some subset of those people are wealthy and interested in collecting sports memorabilia.
I had heard, for an example, and you can back me up on this, that the Houdini poster with the robot is in higher demand by sci-fi collectors than it is by Magic collectors, and will pay a lot more.
I'm not sure. I think they'd give them a run for their money, but certainly, you know, that robot was the first robot to appear in film, from what we understand. So there's definitely that crossover appeal. It's what we call a cross collectible. You know, it's like having a what would be a good example? Let's say I've never had one, but like a baseball signed by Houdini. You know,
okay.
Well, maybe now you've got sports collectors, autograph collectors, Magic collectors, you know, all of a sudden it crosses into these three areas. And so, you know, you may get a much higher price for it than if you were just selling it to a guy who wants Houdini's autograph.
Like the Batman comic book that had Houdini in it featured.
Yeah, not a great book and not wildly right. valuable, but yeah, something along those lines. Exactly.
Yeah, I understand. And whenever that you do acquire these things, then you obviously right now that you can make a catalog and put it out on the internet. But I know from time to time that you make books.
Every month.
You do.
Every month.
You mean you put out a book every month, or you put out the catalog?
Put out a catalog every month. Yeah, auction catalog.
Yes, a printed hard copy.
Yep.
I did not know that. So that is that under squash?
We didn't do one in June. We had to scramble in June. We had to shift our plans around. But, yeah, pretty much every month, sometimes twice a month.
And are they color catalogs?
All color.
Huh. Because I was thinking of the books that you had put out, that I bought both of those from Norm Nielsen, for an example. But were right. those part of that, or was that part of squash, or are they all under the same umbrella?
Those were auction catalogs. So, you know, to regular customers who, you know, want to buy a Magic poster, they got that in the mail as a sales tool, you know, in terms of, you know, direct marketing to them to buy posters from those auctions.
So depending upon how many things you have in an upcoming auction determines how big the book will be, obviously.
Yeah. You know, we're working way ahead. So today I've been at the office cataloging just near the end here for our Circus and Sideshow and Oddity auction. That'll be at the end of September. It's, August 16th now. And at the end of this week, we'll be finishing our cataloging for a late September auction. I've already cataloged approximately 300 items as of today for our Halloween auction this year, which is a Magic auction featuring the collection of Rüdiger Deutsch from Germany. You know, we are scheduled out at this point, I think, pretty concretely to June of next year, and in tentatively probably through the end of next year.
I remember that, of course, David Lindsell had taken a lot of photos, and sure. obviously with his passing, that and he did such a fabulous job of chronicling photos of magicians and their props and so many things, and it's such a loss for him. But are you who have you got, or we've got somebody or a group of people who take the photos then now?
Oh, we have one photographer. Her name is Shelby Ragsdale. She does a great job. She is she's a graduate of the Art Institute of Chicago, and she has no background in magic, but I don't think that makes any difference whatsoever. She's really been able to get up to speed, and she does a fantastic job. I think the photos are wonderful. She's a great asset to our team.
And so in doing that, do you also publish that online, or is it only the hard copy each month that goes out?
No, it's online. It's on most of the auctions are on three different websites, including our own. You can watch the auction live on our website. It takes place live as if you were in the room. Mm-hmm. But you could also go on Live Auctioneers, which is another big clearinghouse for auctions. And then the other one we use on occasion is called Invaluable. So the catalogs are published all three places, and then regular customers receive the hard copies in the mail, and some people collect the catalogs and they buy them from us. You can go on our website and order a catalog. You can order back issues of catalogs if there's something you're particularly interested in.
And if somebody wanted to order or to get on your list as far as getting the catalogs, I guess they just send you an email on that?
Just go on our website, potterauctions.com, and there's a sign-up box right there on the homepage, or you can browse all the upcoming or past auctions on the website and order past catalogs or upcoming catalogs if you want. And if you don't, they're free to browse. You know, there's a PDF you can download, or there's even the online version where you can go through page by page and leave bids or, you know, browse what things have sold.
I was going to ask about bidding. That I assume that you have to sign up and have your credit card and everything like that?
That's correct.
Okay. That's on the same website?
Yep.
Okay. Yep. What about that for the live stream? That you said that there are live auction and there are a couple other companies you work with if you're bidding through another company.
It's the same process. You have to register with all of your pertinent details. And I don't know that they both require necessarily a credit card, but you do have to verify your ID and
sure.
things. So we do have people who bid and then never pay. And, you know, I don't understand why, but, you know, last year some guy bid on $7,000 worth of circus posters in France, and he just started avoiding our phone calls, and he's a known guy in the circus world, and he's just not going to pay, you know. So,
and obviously, you don't send out the products until the
No. These aren't. I don't even own this stuff, you know. Remember, mm-hmm. it's on consignment. That would be irresponsible. Yeah.
Right. And that was what I was going to ask. Also, for those things that are unsold, do they remain like in your store, or are they consignment in which they are still owned by whoever it is that you're auctioning for, and they retain that, or how's that work out?
Any one of a number of ways, depending on what the consignor wants to do. We can offer it to the second highest bidder and sell it. We could put it into a future auction, you know, maybe offer it at the same price or even a lower price. Ironically, sometimes you put something up at the same price and it sells for more when previously you couldn't get a single bid. So go figure that out. But, you know, an auction is very often about who's watching, who has money, who's paying attention that day, that time. You know, maybe there's a new collector who's just found you. Or we can return it to the consignor and they can go their own way with it, you know. So there's usually those three options.
And you also, of course, have live bidders who are there then right now. So you do have a few tables or, I'm sorry, chairs, I guess, set up?
Yeah, we have a gallery and you know, we've set up all the items in showcases with track lights and posters up on the wall and things in showcases. You're welcome to come in a couple days before the auction and view the items, take a look closer. Maybe you want to see, oh, this item has this lot has 100 items in it. I want to look through every one. Well, that's your opportunity to do that. Or you can call us in advance. We'll send you photos or FaceTime you or a video of the lot. And then you make your decisions and you can come in live and bid in person, you know, hold up your card and bid. You can bid live on the computer. We can call you on the phone. Hey, Scott, lot number 12 is coming up and it's going to start at $100, you know, and they narrate it for you and you jump in or not as you see fit. Mm-hmm. Or you can send us your bid in advance and then we'll do it all for you.
How many people typically will attend and how many people can you hold maximum in there?
We've had as many as, I think, 80. We don't have a very large gallery. We're hoping to move at the end of this year. It's 2020 now as we record this, and so hopefully we'll have more space. But we've had as few as zero because, you know, people are comfortable bidding online, especially seeing a live stream with the auctioneer up there talking through. And I address the people on camera all the time when we're streaming the auctions.
By name? You
know, well, I don't know who's out there.
Oh.
But I certainly address the camera as if I were a news anchor or something.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
And, hey, one more bid, Scott. This
yeah.
could be yours, you know.
Okay.
And sometimes they're listening and sometimes they're not. It's like doing a show and telling jokes and nobody laughs, you know. It can be pretty disheartening. But Anyway, we've had zero, we've had 80, and, you know, usually it's 10, 15 people. It's never really a big crowd, to be honest.
I always think one of the most exciting things about auctions is when it seems like it's okay, you know, going once, going twice, and then somebody comes back in, and then it keeps going back up, you know, and then, like, it dies again, and someone else is, like, out of the blue all of a sudden. That just makes it exciting. It's fun to watch, even if I'm not bidding.
It happens online all the time.
Yeah.
We had an auction earlier this year of featuring some of Johnny Thompson's personal effects, his costume, his cups. And normally an auction like that, we would get through in 8 or 9 hours. But it was so active. There was so much bidding. There were so many people on the phone. I think we had 500 or 600 people just on our website bidding,
wow,
watching for 12 hours. And it was – that's like running a marathon. You know, it's like vaudeville is not dead. You know, I was up there for 12 hours.
You didn't take a break, eat or anything? I mean, for dinner?
We took a 15-minute break for lunch.
Wow.
Yeah. So, but it's gratifying. It's gratifying, you know.
So the obvious question that you've been asked, I'm sure, numerous times would be, what has been the most expensive thing with the highest priced item that you've sold?
The highest priced item we've sold is a Houdini poster from Norm Nielsen's collection. It's the most expensive magic poster to ever be sold at auction at $114,000. And it's probably the second most expensive magic item to be sold at auction. The poster pictures Houdini in the water torture cell. It's one of three examples known. The only item I know of selling for more money at auction related to magic was the actual water torture cell itself, which David Copperfield bought a number of years ago in Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
So this poster, I think Norman Lupe at the time they bought it had paid a world record price, and I won't get the number exactly right, but it was something like $50,000 or $60,000 when they bought it.
Mm-hmm.
And we just, you know, we smashed that when we offered it. Yeah, that was unbelievable.
Boy, speaking of the original water torture cell, I remember when he brought that to Magic Live and had presented that and saw that, but then. Did he have a second one? Because I remember there was one that was destroyed that was in the Houdini Museum up in Niagara Falls.
Right.
Did he have a couple of water torture cells? And was that an original one also in Niagara Falls?
So the one David had is the one from Niagara Falls. The one
It is.
It's been restored by David and his team.
Oh.
And it is, you know, with the original pieces as recovered from that fire in Niagara Falls. Yeah.
Because I know that, well, I saw in someone's collection that had just like a little scrap of glass that was from that broken glass that was in there.
Right.
And I thought the whole thing had burned and melted and broken, but apparently not.
It got pretty beat up, but no, David and his team did a magnificent job putting it back together. We have offered a few of those bits and pieces, nails and charred pieces of wood and things, and even those sell for real money.
Yeah, they do. That's amazing then, too. And so in going back to your place and having things that don't sell, that do you have, like if people are coming in, that there you have things that are available, you can buy retails like, hey, this has been here for a while, and that if you're interested in buying this, you know, you can buy them without going to auction?
Well, we have a separate business for that.
That's what I mean.
Yes, we do. It's called Quicker Than the Eye. And, you know, we've ended up buying a number of collections over the years because – in different circumstances, people want to, you know, they don't want to wait for an auction.
Mm.
Hey, I need to get this stuff out of the house now. I need to get paid, you know, so we work out a deal and buy the collection. There was a gentleman in Denver, Earl Room. I don't know if you know.
I know. Yeah, sure did. Yes.
Yeah. He was a funny, funny guy.
And a good speaker. And yeah, I knew him very well.
That's what he did professionally with speaking, right?
That's right.
Anyway, so Earl's wife called me, and she said, look, Earl died, and I want you to buy this. I don't want to wait for an auction. There were 15,000 books in his house.
Wow.
And, so I flew out to Denver, and we loaded a 28-foot truck. It took us, five of us, 3 days. We were taking books out the windows and out of the front door and the back door, and after Earl passed away, his family found out he had 2 or 3 storage lockers they didn't know about. You know, he'd have 6 copies of this book and 12 of this one. But in that instance, his wife said, look, I'd like a check right now, please. And we made a deal, and I bought his library. So it does happen. Yeah.
Yeah. And so those things are available really through, again, I know the catalog, because I get that as well, that update from time to time, little emails. And so do those things, if they're not sold, do you kind of have like a reverse auction and it kind of pricing goes down, or no?
No, it's all, I would say I don't have the, I say this with, we'll call it 98% certainty. I think it's, there are more used and collectible Magic items on that website available for sale right now than maybe any other site on the internet. Probably not as much as eBay, but you know, it's quicker than the eye. It's updated every week. We have literally thousands and thousands of books available, props and posters and gimmicks and autographs and photographs. Miki, who does it, does a fantastic job. She's constantly adding things to the site you can't find anywhere else. And
yeah,
if you're looking for it and it's not on the site, we might have it too. We'll just have to go back in the warehouse and find it for you.
What's been one of the, I'd like to hear a story about something that has been in during one of the auctions, perhaps, that has been one of the funniest things you've sold or something.
Ooh, funniest things. I mean, there's we've sold trunken heads, and we've sold taxidermy, and we've got a bunch coming up later this year. We've sold, conjoined animals, and we've sold all kinds of odd things. We usually have a good laugh during an auction because something will come out of my mouth and I'll say, are we really selling this? And I wish I need a better anecdote file, but there's definitely days where we say, how is this conversation happening right now? You know, we're talking about something that is just utterly bizarre. But for us, it's that radio-controlled talking skull. Now, maybe to a magician, that's not weird, but out in the big wide world, it's a pretty strange thing to talk about matter-of-factly. You know?
I think like when you do sell circus posters, I assume there are other circus memorabilia, not just ephemera, that are things that are odd and unusual.
Yeah, Johnny Fox was a great sword swallower, a friend of mine, and when we offered his collection a few years ago, we were selling art made out of human hair, and we were selling human skulls, and we were selling some of the swords that John swallowed, sideshow banners. We sold things from Johnny X's career and life. You know, he was the half man who was the star of the movie Freaks, directed by Todd Browning. We actually sold Johnny's own copy of that movie. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but Todd Brown. Oh, you have, yeah.
Yep, very familiar with it. Seen it two or three times.
Yeah, so Johnny had a actual giant reel that he used to screen the film with, and we sold his copy of that footage.
I didn't know Johnny that well, but I knew him from coming to the Renaissance Festival here in Houston from time to time, and we always spent some time. He did some great coin work. I mean, I don't think people appreciate what a good magician that he was, actually. They always think of him as being, of course, a sword swallower and sideshow guy.
But he studied with Slidini.
I did not know that. That's interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. He had an amazing collection. You know, furry fish, and we had it was the one thing I did not take back to Chicago from Johnny's place in Connecticut was he had a mummified baboon, and for some reason that just was the thing that put me over the edge, so we put that there. The other stuff, I don't know, there was a cat that was mummified that was stuck in the wall, we took that, and all kinds of other bizarre things, but the baboon kind of freaked me out
a little bit.
Yeah.
Was it posed like in the wild, or was it like holding a tray with a little funny hat, or what?
It was mummified. It was not taxidermy, so it was just the skin stretched over the bones, and it was it was just creepy.
Like it was attacking. Huh. Wow.
Oh, it's creepy.
And somebody bought that.
We know that I would not take that. I left that behind.
Oh, okay.
Mummified cat, I had no problem. But the baboon...
A little bit much.
That was too much for me.
That is funny. And now we talk about squash printing then for just a minute. There are other books and things that you publish under squash printing. I know like Adele...
Rindris.
Thank you. Yeah. And other kinds of books that are not related to your auctions. Right. What are some of the other books and titles? You had mentioned John Bannon and others.
Yeah, so I've done three books with John: High Caliber, Destination Zero, Mentalissimo, all of which are now out of print. I did a book with Bruce Bernstein called Unreal, published David Benn's biography of Di Vernon. You mentioned Adele's book. Earlier this year, I published a book about Susie Wandas, who is a very accomplished manipulator from Belgium. I've gotten some really great reviews of that. It's written by a father and son team, Kobe and Christ van Herwegen. This Christmas, you know, if all the stars align, we'll have a huge book by John Fisher, who was the producer of the Paul Daniels Show and many, many other television shows in the UK. It's called Heroes of Magic. I am so, so excited by this project. It's profiles of 25 great, great performers, including Paul Daniels, Ricky Jay, David Devant, Robert Hardman, Al Coran, Arturo Brichetti, and Jay Marshall, on and on and on. It's going to be spectacular. 400-500-page oversized book. It's kind of the best combination of coffee table book and biography you could hope for. I have a number of good projects in the works for next year. If Magic Live happens, I'm hoping to have at least two, but maybe three and possibly four new books at the convention. Combination of trick books and history books. What else? John Lubbock's book, Handsome Jack, that's been a great seller for us. It's in its third printing. So
great stuff in there.
Yeah, it's a fantastic book. So that's just been my business for the last 15 years or so, doing, you know, two books a year, give or take, when time allows.
That's what I was going to ask about. I've, of course, worked on publishing some books as well. I know how long that it takes typically, and it sounds like you're just grinding these things out just overnight, practically. It takes me like 5 years or something, and you're doing it like within a year from start to finish.
One or two a year, and I definitely, you know, as the auction business has grown, there have been a couple of years where I haven't been able to publish anything. But, you know, yeah, this year we'll do two. And I'm so proud of the one about Susie Wandas. And I don't get excited about a whole lot, but John's book is really going to be something special. It's mm-hmm. We've been working hard on it for the last 3-4 months. And I think a lot of people are going to love it.
I remember somewhere on Facebook or something about talking about Susie Wandas, and the two gentlemen we were talking about over in Holland or someplace.
They're Belgium.
Belgium, yeah, who were talking about that. And that sounded like that was quite an interesting book and quite a life that she had that not many people know about, Susie Wandas.
No, and Kobe particularly did a lot of work into, you know, and research into her life, traveling over to the States, reading her scrapbooks, interviewing people who knew her and were friends with her, took care of her. You know, I just missed Susie by a few years. She used to go to the Abbott's get-togethers every year because she ended up marrying Dr. Zina Bennett in Detroit and moving to the U.S. And so she went to Abbott's every year, where she was a fixture just up until before she passed away. Mm-hmm. But she really, you know, she basically was born in a circus wagon on a fairground in Belgium. And her father ran a little theater, you know, that played these fairgrounds and things. She used to do an act balancing on a giant ball playing the violin, and her, you know, brother and mother were in the act, and so on and so forth. And she developed into this really elegant, refined manipulator, playing the biggest stages in variety. And she managed to live through and succeed through World War I. She managed to live through and succeed through World War II. She watched friends and colleagues be killed by the Nazis. So, you know, she really gets her due in this book. You see some beautiful pictures of her and get an understanding of why she was as successful as she was, learn a little bit about the techniques she came up with. You know, she wasn't doing a Chavez act. You know, she came up with this manipulative routine, cigarettes and cards and so on and so forth. You know, coin Miser's Dream routine, learning from Talma and T. Nelson Downs, you know, as inspiration.
But she's wearing a dress, where you'd think that she'd have some opportunity for some pockets and things that, unlike.
Yeah, she had to figure out her own way of doing a lot of things that other people take for granted, you know.
remember talking to Lisa Mena about that kind of a thing, about the advantages. Often people think, well, it's a disadvantage for women. Well, actually, there are a lot more advantages than you might think. And so that'd be interesting. Did she have some video out there as well?
There's a little bit of footage of her doing manipulation taken in her later years after she'd moved to Detroit. But I'm not saying that because, I'm trying to take something away from her or give her a pass because she was, you know, getting a little bit older. There's some things in there. You look at her and you go, how did you do that? I've seen a lot of people manipulate cards, but there's something there going on that's pretty sophisticated.
Yeah.
So it's not refined performance, film or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, there is some footage out there. I know that I think Todd Carr put some of it out at one point on one of his DVDs that he released, which I don't think is available any further. But it's worth tracking down if you can find it.
Well, the John Fisher book that you're talking about, I think, will be very exciting because I know that he is just was a dynamo of a producer in the UK. There are so many things and was the go-to guy. And he put together the Masters of Magic or something like that was a series?
I think you're thinking of Best of Magic.
Best of Magic, that was it.
Best of Magic, which may be... I mean, it may even outstrip the Paul Daniels show in terms of the unbelievable showcase that it was for all this talent. You know, I think Interlude, you know, the illusion we all kind of take for granted premiered on that show. You know, you think about all of the, you know, Brachetti and Jeff Durham and Paul and Dave Williamson and on and on and on. You can
Rudy
find
Kobe, I think, was there.
But yeah, Rudy Kobe, absolutely. You know, he really was scouring the earth for the best talent available and got them for the show. You can watch some of it on YouTube. Not all of the episodes are there, but many of them. And yes, it was produced a generation ago. But, you know, that doesn't take anything away from the fact that, you know, these acts are just fantastic.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I've got the DVD set. I think I've got all of them, all of the... Best of Magic. I haven't watched them in a long time, but I've got, you know, just a set of all those DVDs from the shows. And they had a poster out for a while on that also. Do you remember?
Yeah.
But are you going to reproduce the poster and put that out along with the book?
I don't think so. The book is based on a show that John did called Heroes of Magic. And so it is profiles of these 25 guys, Fred Capps, like I said before, Robert Harmon, Jay Marshall, Billy McComb, you know, many people that I think will resonate with you know, readers, and a few that, you know, seem a little bit more distant in the past. David Devant, I'm not sure anybody is left who really vividly remembers a David Devant performance.
No.
But John produced a wonderful program about these magicians. And what's even more remarkable is out of, I think, 25 people in the book, he knew all but two of them. And he produced on television, I think, 20 of them.
Wow.
So, you know, remember, 11 years of the Paul Daniels show. He put Ricky Jay, I think, on his first international TV show with Michael Parkinson. Three guys who are in this book were all on John's first magic special that he produced for TV. Richie Arty, Ricky Jay, and Fred Capps, all on that Michael Parkinson magic show, which you can watch, I think, on YouTube. Anyway, I'm very excited if you can't tell.
There was a video that was recently shown on the Collector's Corner. David Sandy has that is on Facebook that was just amazing. And he had some problems. Apparently, Richie Arty had some problems with his broomstick suspension. And as he was walking over at the table, there was Fred Capps and Ricky Jay. And I thought, wow, this must have been a heck of a show.
Yeah. So imagine that's your entree as a producer of, you know, variety and television for the BBC. Well, I believe that was John's first magic special for the BBC. It was the Michael Parkinson magic show.
Yeah. I think it was Levent, I think, actually, who had the video on that. Because Levent's doing a book on Richie Arty right now, which should be, I don't know when it's coming out, but that's going to be awesome also.
Absolutely. That's looking forward to it.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you then also about how people can prepare their collections. In other words, we talked about how that you might acquire things from time to time, but there are proactive things that people, as they get to a certain time in life, are thinking, you know, I'm not going to live forever, and I need to figure out how I'm going to dispense of these things, rather than leaving them to my heirs or survivors to say, I don't know what's going to be done with this. And I'm sure you've heard horror stories that you could share.
Sure.
So what would you suggest?
I think it's there are a lot of suggestions I could make, and but some of them are based on what's your goal. You know, if it's strictly financial, I would say, you know, and it's your financial goal, maybe you need to sell them before it's too late. You know, maybe you need to get involved and start moving things along. There's a lot of different ways you can do that yourself. You could sell them to people you know. You could sell them on eBay, on Facebook, et cetera, et cetera. If your goal is to set something up so as to not burden people in your life, then I would just say start asking questions, get an idea of what the value of your collection is, and then decide who do you want to handle it after you're gone, and write it down. Make sure it's clear. Take action so that there's no disputes between your children, so that there's no legal problems. And I'm not saying that you can do that with, you know, 100% level of certainty, because I mean, I've been involved in estates that 15 years later, after the person, you know, passed away, the estate is still open and the attorney is still involved because there are still challenges and issues. But I would say try to take action before it's too late. You know, what's the old gag about my grandfather sold this to me on his deathbed, but I wrote him a check, you know, yeah. That kind of stuff.
Right.
And it's like, you know, it's better to do it when you're not doing it under duress. Mm-hmm. You know, never make a decision when it's, you know, come down to the 11th hour. I just would say plan ahead.
Is it better to go to an attorney as opposed to just writing it on a piece of paper someplace?
It depends on what you have. I mean, if you have two shelves of magic books, it's probably not going to change somebody's life, right?
Right.
But if you have property and you have a collection of real tangible value, and it's not for me to be a financial planner and tell you it should be $10,000 or more, or $100,000 or more, or what have you. But, you know, can become a genuine burden to those people who have to figure out what to do with it after you're gone.
My daughter-in-law had said the same thing to me some time ago when my wife was still alive, and that she said, called me Big Pops, said, you know, Big Pop, or actually Pop Pops, that whenever, that I hope, I don't mean this bad, but I hope that you go before Gigi, because I don't want to have to be the one to try to figure out what all this stuff is you've got and how much it's going to be worth. Well, now my wife is gone. Now it's just me, and I'm thinking, yeah, they are going to have to figure this all out if I don't get it all written down. And I mean, I many years ago was inspired by Jay Marshall to do I have a spreadsheet of all my books. I've got 1,000 books, and some are valuable. I've got, you know, Revelations and several other, you know, first editions of some books that have some value. And for the most part, I'm sure that the value of the books are probably less than 50% if you're going to resell them, probably about 30% of their original retail value for someone to resell that. So what I've done, like Jay had suggested, was not only the name of the book and the author, when it was done, and whether it's the first edition or not, but then also how much I paid for that and whether it's been autographed, etc. So I can actually look in the column or in the row and add it all up and say, okay, I've got X thousands of dollars, you know, worth of books that are over here. So I catalog all my books, and as I get new ones, if I have a book plate in it, then I know that that's in my, you know, then if I take a book off the shelf and it doesn't have my book plate in it, then I will put it in my spreadsheet. Aside from that, then I've got just closets full of magic crap, you know, and things that I perform with and everything. And to a degree, that might have some value, but not as much probably as what the books do. And I don't think I have really any kind of props that belong to anybody that would be of import necessarily. So in something like that, I probably should say, okay, well, I need to arrange for someone to come in and buy that book collection.
Okay, fair enough. I mean, I think that the best thing you could do, obviously you have to find a system that works for you and your family and your comfort level, but how about one paragraph that just says, upon my death, I'd like the following to happen, you know, and they may or may not follow your instructions, but certainly you can put their mind at ease saying, look, I have this person available and I trust this person. And, you know, whether it's your friend or somebody in your magic club or, you know, maybe they're, you know, you're talking about Dick and Charlie, somebody like that. You know, here are the people that I would contact that, you know, I think are trustworthy and would do a good job for you. You know, it doesn't have to be anything crazy detail. I mean, it just depends on your goals. And also, you know, if you know you have real substantial value in your collection, maybe you do need to set up a trust. Maybe you do need to have it put in your will. You know, we've been contacted by many attorneys who say, you know, your company has been specifically named in our trustees document, and you are the firm that has been chosen to handle this property. You know, so it's a function a little bit of value. It's a function a little bit of what does your family know? Maybe you want to give it all away. You know, maybe you want to donate it somewhere. You got to set that up in advance, because I got to tell you, most institutions probably won't take old magic books.
No, that probably is something in which that it needs to be sold, auctioned, or whatever, and the value of that go to wherever that you want to designate. So, as you say, that's good advice.
Too. I hesitate a little bit to go into all the ins and outs and details of, you know, estate planning and trusts and all that kind of stuff. I'm not a professional, but I do know that I've been in so many situations. I was in one recently, I think I mentioned, in California. A gentleman called me 2 weeks before he died. He knew he was going to pass away, and he put his wife on the phone and he said, this is the person that I want to handle this material, meaning me. And he gave us both very specific instructions, and he just wanted it to be all clear. You know, but I've been in other situations where I go and I handle maybe books or tricks or whatever it may be. And then there are other real valuable, tangible assets, a workshop full of tools or jewelry or what have you, things I don't handle. And people are prone to say, I don't want the headache, I want to give it away, you know, or they'll sell it for a very low price. It happens all the time.
That's another thing. Whenever I think, as a magician who has purchased all this stuff, they're going to, because there's always the joke again, it's like, well, my wife thinks I only paid this much for it, but really, which is a problem, because whenever they die, I say, well, he apparently didn't pay much for it, because you've been telling her, you know, that the value is lower.
It's $2, right?
You know? Yeah. And so she thinks, well, it's worthless, and then realize, oh my gosh, you know, he's giving away all of this kind of stuff. On the other hand, you have something in which that the magicians think, well, this is really valuable, and that it's I should at least get the retail value or more back for whatever I paid for it. And so they have unreasonable expectations of what they think the value of their collection is. And that's where I think you need to have an outside or a third party or someone who has sold or resold, such as yourself and others, who can come in and assess it. In other words, I don't think I am good at assessing the value of my stuff, because more than likely, I think it's just like anything else. You always overestimate to your benefit as to what you think the value is.
Sure. Or you bought a book for $50 at a convention, and now it's just a used book, you know, and so it's worth, you know, $15 to $25, you know, no matter what the guy says on eBay and he's asking 300, you know, some of this stuff is just used stuff, you know, and on the other hand, some of it is quite valuable. Maybe you paid $40 for a copy of Pure Effect from Darren Brown or from Charlie, Dick and Charlie, when they published it. Mm-hmm. And now it's worth $150 or $200, you know. Mm-hmm. So there is some specialized knowledge required. But, you know, in many cases, if we're just talking specifically about magic, I love Mark Mason, but, you know, my guess is a lot of the tricks that he sold you for $40, $50, $80 are worth 20% of what you paid for.
Yeah, a fraction of what you paid for it. Yeah, I'm sure that's true. Also, that I would suspect that if a book is autographed, it has more value, and perhaps who it may have been owned by. So, in other words, if you're buying the Vernon collection or something, that there is some intrinsic value there.
Sure. I mean, that's what I actually, personally, I don't collect much anymore, but I do collect association copies of books. So books signed from one well-known individual to another. And so, yes, absolutely, I'll pay a lot more if the book was signed to Chung Ling Su as opposed to being signed to John Doe. You know, absolutely. Yeah, it makes a big difference.
I was going to say, as to who's going to be well-known or what would be considered valuable. Every magician thinks that I am very important, so it belonged to my collection, so it's basically worth a lot, you know. But I think sometimes you have to just assess your own value.
there's a certain amount of ego checking.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. Well, listen, I appreciate the time you've given me over here. And this has been wonderful and valuable, I think, to a lot of us then as well in figuring all this out and understanding really kind of how this whole auction process works. And for more information for people to find out the next auction and where they can get that, again, they go to what website?
They go to our website, potterauctions.com, and if you're stuck at home on a Saturday and you want to watch a live auction, you can stream them there as well. There's a big button right on the homepage. It just says bid online. You can bid in advance, or you can listen to my same 10 stale jokes every auction. I will utter them into the camera without fail, and if you're so compelled, you can click the bid button and maybe take something home that you've always wanted.
And before we do close, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word, and I always like to close by asking my guests what it is that is their philosophy of life. What is your magic word or phrase?
Philosophy of life. Yeah. I don't know that it would be a word or phrase. I would just say, whatever you do, do it to a high standard.
Love that. Very good. Gabe, thanks very much. I appreciate your time. You've just been wonderful.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
You bet. So for The Magic Word Podcast, that was Gabe Fiore. This is Scotty out. Well, that was excellent. Thank you very much, Gabe, for being my guest this week on the Magic Word Podcast. I think we have a lot of information there that you've given us and some things, an assignment basically for us to do, to go through and assess the things we have and kind of have some soul searching also of how much that we think all this stuff is really worth, and maybe time to have a real true heart to heart with your family and tell them, finally fess up as to how much you've been spending for this. At least at some point in your life, I think that's going to have to be the conversation to have, so this way that people will know what that is going to be worth to them. So anyhow, thank you, Gabe. That was really good. And I also want to thank you, Gabe, very much for offering the prizes that our listeners will have a chance to win. And there was a 2-volume set on the Golden Age of Magic Posters that was for the Nielsen poster collection that happened a few years ago, and each book is just beautifully bound with a nice paper. The colors are beautiful, and it's just a beautiful poster book. There would be a nice coffee table book kind of a thing, certainly, and well worth looking through. And if you win, I mean, my gosh, it's free, because I paid for mine when they first came out because I wanted to take a look at these posters. I didn't think I was going to be able to afford to buy any of them, and I was right, but I just enjoy looking through this fabulous collection again of our friend Norm and Lupe that they had. It's marvelous. So in order to sign up for the contest, all you need to do is to go to themagicwordpodcast.com, this week's episode, which is number 580. And there will be a form at the bottom of there where you'll put in your name and email address and just hit submit and or enter now, I guess is what it says. And boom, Robert is your mother's brother. So that's just the way that it goes, making it very easy. And this is open and available to everyone who is a U.S. resident. And I say that because that way that he will be shipping the prizes directly to you free of charge. However, if you live outside of the U.S. or its territories, you can still enter. And if your name happens to be randomly drawn, then we will notify you how much the postage is going to be and that if you're willing to pay or reimburse Gabe for the foreign postage, then he'll be glad to send the books over to you then as well. But again, there are 2 hardback books that are going to be sent. So there are 2 separate prizes. So again, there are 2 sets. So there'll be 2 winners of the 2-volume books on the Golden Age of Magic Posters, the Nielsen Art Poster Collection. So if you haven't already subscribed to the Magic Word Podcast pod letter, it's a weekly newsletter letting you know about who's going to be on each week, who's coming up next week, some suggestions from the archives. Plus, it notifies you about contests like this. And let me also say that I should suggest that you enter the contest soon, because it's only going to run for a couple of weeks. So if you're listening to this podcast late, then it may be too late for you to enter the contest, and we may have already drawn the name. So that's why it's important for you to, if you don't get around to listening to all the podcasts in succession, since they come out weekly, at least take a look at the pod letter so that you know that there's a contest that you need to go and enter before that contest is gone. So all you have to do, again, is go to the website, and you'll see a little pop-up form there for subscribing to the pod letter. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember, whatever you do, do it to a high standard. This is Scotty out.